Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, domestic violence is just one of the many problems of violent sports. We'll take a close look at American football and its discontents.
Then, scholars analyze the role of comedy in politics.
Domestic violence and sexual abuse may have tarnished American football, but the problem may be much deeper than the headlines suggest, according to our next guest. The American football system damages its players, the families, and communities. Steve Almond is with us. He's a journalist and author of three books, including his latest, Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto. Welcome, Steve Almond. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Let's start with this brief and wildly subjective history of football. You said it really began more or less as a series of controlled riots. How did it become football?
Yeah, well, it became football. So it really was a hazing ritual. And this is going back to the 1850s, basically the middle of the 19th century. And it combined elements, gradually sort of appropriated elements from soccer, mostly from rugby. It was a very violent game and there was no passing. It was kind of these masses of young players basically smashing into one another. And it really became so violent. In 1904, there were 18 prep school and college kids. There was no pro game at that time, so there are these prep school and college kids who were killed playing the game, and a whole bunch of others who were paralyzed or otherwise disfigured. And, you know, the various schools started to threaten to actually abolish football, and a number of them actually did. And Teddy Roosevelt, who was a big football player and supporter of football, he thought it was a manly game, of course, and he had a son at Harvard who had just gotten his nose broken. He called a bunch of school officials to the White House and said, look, you know, we want you to reform the game, but not in, don't make it too ladylike, was what he said in essence. And in fact, he was suggesting that it was the school officials who really realized, or the people who were, you know, heads of the football teams, coaches and stuff, who realized we need to do something to reform the game to make it less violent. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's really, people aren't going to stand for it. There were editorials calling for its abolition all over the country. And so what they did is they basically created a neutral zone. They legalized the forward pass. They made a number of crucial innovations that basically gave the game suddenly had a Z-axis. You know, you could throw the ball, put more of an emphasis on speed and agility, and it spread the game out. It wasn't just these masses of guys running at one another. And it actually made the game far more dramatically interesting. That's the amazing thing about the history of football, is that it survived its savagery, and because of the reforms, the game became so much more suspenseful. It had a real, much greater narrative sense, and people, it got more and more popular to the point that a pro league started and it became a big business, essentially. But it's fascinating because it was sort of these incremental innovations. It wasn't just all at once it became the game we know now. It's been tinkered with over the years, largely in response to the fact that it was just so brutal and violent in its early days.
It's interesting to me to question why the U.S. really made the American version of football the big sport, sure, while in other countries, mostly we see what they call football, which is soccer. And then down here in the Southern Hemisphere, we have rugby as a very big sport. Why do you speculate that it became this sport?
That's a complicated question. I speculated about it, and a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me and have thought about it a lot longer than I have offer some really smart speculation about it as well. And one of the things that you have to realize is, you know, America has this in its bloodstream, is the idea of the regeneration of the spirit through violence. You know, in the colonial days, certainly the frontier and the way in which essentially a genocide was what made Manifest Destiny possible, or was actually the direct result of Manifest Destiny. There's always been the idea that the way that American, and especially American masculinity, affirms itself in the world is through violence and aggression, controlled violence and aggression. So that's very much what football is about, as compared with sort of the pastoral nature of baseball. It's a collision sport. It is about putting your body and your will at risk against another man and seeing, you know, surviving a certain kind of danger and finding not only an appropriate but a heroic context for violence. That is, I think, just an American trait. I also think that the time that football came along was a fascinating time in American history, because it was on the heels of the Industrial Revolution, where people who had lived off the land and had been, especially the men, had been defined by very vigorous physical activity and the possibility of danger, carrying a rifle, you know, making sure that you could survive in this kind of rugged wilderness or frontier. And in fact, suddenly these American men were in cities, in factories, in offices, and they were looking for a way to connect back to the sort of masculine ideals of their immediate forebears. And football offered them that. It was a spectacle that, again, was both incredibly narratively satisfying and suspenseful, competitive, which is another big part of the American experience, is that it's a hyper-competitive culture, great emphasis on winning and losing in a kind of public way. And people suffer and struggle with those things privately in the United States, but in fact, it's very gratifying for that reason to see it played out in a very public, overt way. So I think that had a lot to do with it, and I think that, you know, people being able to connect to a game that really was very much about an overt and exalted brand of masculinity at a time that men were feeling increasingly hemmed in and disconnected from that part of their identities. That was a big engine. And I think essentially that the game, once it became something that, once television came along, it's the perfect game for television because of its dramatic possibilities, because of the fact that the game itself is contained in a box. Unlike baseball, where you've got this giant field, most of the action in football is contained in a smaller area. And, you know, I think once the promoters of football realized that there was gold in them, there are tackles, they really quickly innovated the way that the game was presented to the public, the pageantry of it, the spectacle of it, the uniforms, the cheerleaders, the big stadium. You know, America's very good at presenting big public spectacles. This is kind of a ritualized, romanticized form of violence. It's a simulated form of combat, and we're good at that stuff. I don't know morally that that's a good thing to be good at, but we are very good at it.
And it was much faster than other sports at the time, such as baseball.
Oh, yeah. I mean, baseball was really, you know, I think the famous quote is baseball is what we were, football is what we are. You know, that there was something about the way in which the culture sped up after the Industrial Revolution, and you have such an increase in literally the way that people can move around. The mobility kind of goes crazy, and everything is all about speed. The media becomes kind of, you know, dedicated to getting stories out quickly. And people themselves are able to move about the world and communicate much more quickly. And, of course, we're seeing that now. You know, we've only gotten faster and faster and faster. And I think football is one of those games that very much plugs into that. It, you know, soccer is an amazing game, but there isn't that much scoring and there isn't that much strategic density of strategy is not that great. You know, football really plugged into the way that capitalism, especially late model capitalism, but even the early forms of capitalism, was very much about sort of a managerial class, a very complicated perspective, making sure that a whole bunch of people could work together interdependently, like in an office or a corporation. It's really a very corporate kind of sport. It has moments of great beauty and improvisation, but if you've ever seen an NFL playbook, it's like, you know, thicker than a phone book. It's a giant, complicated document that has to sort of take into account a million different contingencies and possibilities and routes being run. So you have that incredible strategic density, which is why I think it's the secret vice of the intellectual. But at the same time, there are these moments of primal aggression and real unexpected beauty and liberation when the running back just makes just the right cut, bursts through the hole, heads for the end zone, you know, with nothing but grass between him and glory. These are the kind of things that football supplies that are much more visceral and satisfying, frankly, as a fan of the game than for, you know, baseball or basketball, where there's constantly scoring. The momentum swings very quickly. Just as a writer, as somebody who's interested in narrative, I find football so much more satisfying than other sports. Makes me wish I could watch it. You know, I'm no longer watching the game, but I still miss it.
Yes, you say you're actually against football.
Well, yeah, the name of the book is a little bit dopey, frankly. The name of the book, the name that I wanted was This Eager Violence of the Heart. And I wanted to call it a meditation or maybe even a lamentation, because that's what I think it is. It's, I get it that for commercial purposes, they wanted to say, oh, well, against football and, you know, kind of get people stirred up. But if you read the book, I'm more heartbroken than angry. It's more heartbreaking that there was this beautiful game that I played a little bit as a kid and enjoyed so much, has so much beauty to it, so intricate. There's the players themselves, I believe, are really valorous and heroic and, you know, incredibly disciplined. And at the same time, they have just physical gifts that the rest of us can only dream about. I mean, Americans also love to see greatness, and football is a way, athletics in general, but football in particular, is a way of seeing greatness as measured against real danger. These guys are always in danger. So I think, you know, there's a real sense, for me anyway, that I'm just more heartbroken that there's this incredibly huge corrupt industry that's grown up around the game.
And become more so. I thought it was really very interesting, too, how football was sort of a uniting subject between people who normally would never have anything in common, like President Nixon and Hunter S. Thompson.
Right. Yeah, its appeal is so broad that it really cuts across a lot of, but I think primarily for men, I'll say, it's this kind of lingua franca. I find that argument ultimately pretty sad in a way. It's true, but it's sad that we need such a savage game to feel that we can speak to people of a different socioeconomic status, different geographic region, different sensibility. Like the fact that the glue of American male culture is this profoundly violent game that's also this rapacious, greedy industry, to me is part of the heartbreaking aspect of football. But it's true also that, you know, it's something I can immediately kind of connect to another guy around. I will say that that connection is really a kind of vouchsafing of our masculinity, of our bona fides, of our heterosexuality. And that aspect too of it is also kind of creepy to me, that, you know, sports in general and football in particular is one way in which you sort of say, yeah, I'm a dude. Yep, that's right. I'm a dude. Yeah, there's no question. I like ladies and I'm a dude, you know. I think that's always an undercurrent, although we don't talk about that. That's partly what the whole language of sports is a way for men to be able to have discourse where otherwise they feel that just connecting with a man around something else, family or spirituality or whatever it is, would somehow make them suspect.
So here we have presidents on the left and the right. We have Eisenhower, we have the Kennedys, we have Nixon, and we have people like Abby Hoffman, we have the Black Panthers. They all have this common lingo, so to speak. It maybe is the common ground.
Okay, but what is the nature of the common ground? I mean, I hear this argument a lot, and that, you know, sort of, oh, it bonds people. Well, okay, so does tuberculosis, you know? What's the nature of the discourse that's going on around the game, and why is it necessary? You know, I have a neighbor who I love, but I do find it, and he's a great guy, but I do find it disheartening that we need a football game in order to spend time together. Do you know what I mean? Like, wait a second, why can't we just find comfort and succor in one another's company? Why can't we honestly talk about the stuff that we struggle with as parents and as, you know, husbands and so forth? I'm not saying that it isn't true that people bond over football, but given the fact that a third of the players end up with brain damage and that we as fans consuming the violence, you know, these guys sort of in their prime and their youth, ultimately down the road, they're going to wind up with serious cognitive ailments like dementia and Alzheimer's and ALS. There's something unwholesome about the fact that we need such a savage, violent game to connect with one another.
Well, let's talk about some of these brain injuries. You spent quite a bit of time in your book writing about this. You told stories, for example, this Dave Durson, who had a form of dementia,
right,
shot himself, and then asked to have his brain used for research.
Right.
Tell us this story and help us understand what the sort of common ailment here is.
It's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's basically a form of dementia that was one time was called, I think, dementia pugilistica. It was associated with boxing, but it's basically a deterioration of the brain from repeated hits. The brain is a soft organ inside a hard shell. When the brain is knocked around, when you run into somebody, when you collide with somebody, that brain smashes up against the inside wall of the skull, and it causes little damage to the brain. This happens to football players because it's a collision sport. Hundreds and thousands of times, and even in a particular season, it happens in practice, it happens in the games, and everybody focuses on concussions, big brain traumas where, you know, somebody will pass out, be wobbly afterwards, have headaches, sensitivity to light. You can tell that there's been a major trauma to the brain. But the medical research has really caught up with football and sports in general, and what we now know is that it's the accretion of subconcussive hits that can lead to this deterioration of the brain. So those happen all the time, and it's not like somebody's being led off the field and you realize they're injured. It's an invisible form of injury that builds up over time, and it's actually terrifying for players because, you know, there's a study that was done in Purdue, at Purdue University, that I talk about in the book, where they looked at the effect of concussions, or they're trying to look at the effect of concussions on high school players. So they put monitors in a couple dozen players' helmets, and they wanted to see what the brain activity was for the kids with concussions. concussions, and then they had a control group of kids who'd never had concussions. The problem is that the kids in the control group were showing diminished brain function as well. And over the course of one season, their brain function for some of these kids had actually disappeared in one of their frontal lobes. That's how much their brain activity had diminished. That's a high school kid who's never been diagnosed with a concussion, who has no function in one of their frontal lobes. That should be deeply terrifying to any parent, but more than that, to anybody who's a fan of football, that the game is inherently that violent. And I know people talk about, well, what about better equipment and changing the rules? It's like, well, look, unless it becomes fundamentally a different game, not the violent game that we so enjoy consuming with the parabolic mics on the sidelines picking up every decibel of every bone-crunching hit and the replays of the most violent sequences broadcast over and over again, unless we, the fans, decide that that brutality is too much, it's going to stay in the game. And no matter what they do to tweak the rules, there are going to be these subconcussive hits. And because the players are bigger and stronger and faster than ever, because of the physics of it, mass times acceleration equals force, they're going to continue to do damage. The NFL just admitted in federal court that they anticipate 30% of their former players are going to wind up with brain damage at a significantly younger age than the rest of the population. That's really not morally, as a society, I don't think that's tenable. I don't think we would accept that in any other realm of the culture. And I think legally and financially, it's hard to have a business model where a third of your employees, you just admit up front, are going to get brain damage.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Steve Almond about his new book, Against Football. You also mentioned that their lives are actually shortened, maybe by 20 years.
Well, I have to be honest, it's not clear what the figures, the mortality figures are. It's just absolutely not clear. There's one study the NFL likes to cite that shows football players have longer lives. Other researchers who are not affiliated with the NFL suggest that it's actually shortening the athletes' lives. Nobody knows. Until a decent longitudinal study is done, nobody can say with any assurance. What we can say is that the quality of their life is very likely to be diminished. And it's not just because of brain injuries. These guys are absolutely beaten up. Nobody who's a fan, I don't think, realizes how beat up a football player is, how profoundly violent the game is. You know, we watch from the comfort of our couches. The players have helmets on and uniforms. We do not understand exactly the kind of pain and brutality of guys that big and fast slamming into one another with helmets on. It's just impossible to convey. You would literally need to have some kind of chair that, you know, was like the real NFL experience, and it took the fan and basically flung him onto the floor at full force with like the force of a 300-pound lineman. Then we could begin to understand how beat up these guys are in a day-in, day-out way. But if you talk to any former player at the highest levels, college or pro, or you read, for instance, the memoirs of former players, they're all about how beat up their bodies are. Not to mention that psychologically and emotionally, it's really tough when your place of work is a place where you could get booed by 50,000 people or excoriated by an entire community if you drop the big pass or, you know, somehow fail to perform or get injured and don't come back early enough. So there's all this pressure that's on these players physically, psychologically, and so forth. And, you know, we're seeing right now that players' aggression on the field is also being expressed off the field. And that shouldn't come as any shock to us.
And it shouldn't come as a shock to us because?
Because they are trained from the time they're 5 years old to suppress their empathy and to express their aggression on the field. That is exactly how you become a great football player, is you simply say, I'm going to tackle this guy and make sure he doesn't get up again, or I'm going to run over him if I need to. That's how you play football. And it's really hard to say to somebody after 20 years of indoctrinating him in a thought system that says, in order to be effective in the world, I've got to suppress my empathy and express my aggression. Hey, but that's really only on the field. The moment you step over that chalk line, you know, past the cheerleaders, who are the designated symbols of femininity in this world, basically sexual ornaments, once you're off that field, you have to be a gentleman role model. I just don't think that's the way that people function.
It's a little bit like soldiers, isn't it? Where they get trained to essentially be aggressive, yeah, and then they have to go home and try to be gentle with their families?
Correct. I wouldn't say it's a little like soldiers. I say it's a lot like soldiers. I mean, it's a simulated form of combat. And by the way, this is to me, kind of the heartbreaking aspect of stories in which people are jumping on athletes, you know, for sins off the field. Yes, they should be held accountable. Yes, the legal system should hold them accountable, even if they're rich, famous athletes. They shouldn't be exempt. But we should understand that it is our consumption of the violence as fans that causes them to, in stressful situations, when they make impulsive decisions, the direction that their mind and body goes towards is fight. They don't think flight, they think fight. And, you know, we're a part of that system.
And speaking of the system, one of the pieces of the system is the coach. You described a story in which a coach essentially manipulated a player. It was Ted Johnson, who was supposed to, because he'd had a concussion, be given the jersey that said no hard contact. What happened in that story, and how frequently does this happen?
What happened is that Johnson knew he was hurt and didn't want to have a full contact jersey on. He went to a trainer when he found it in his locker and said, hey, I need a red jersey, minimal contact jersey, because I have a concussion. I'm still recovering. And he found the trainer said, oh, yeah, it's a mistake. You're not cleared for contact. So Johnson puts on the red jersey. Out on the practice field, as they're preparing for a contact drill, an assistant trainer brings him a blue jersey, a contact jersey, and says Coach Belichick had directed him to do so. Johnson is very angry about this, but he puts the jersey on anyway. And the reason he does that is because he's trying to keep his job, he's trying to keep his sense of pride, and this game is all about the highest accolade that we give to a player in football is that they play hurt, that they're willing to sacrifice. It's almost a Christian idea, you know, that the sort of the ravaged body is the signifier of devotion to the ultimate cause, which in this case is, you know, sort of the victory, the team's triumph. So players have this very, I would say, almost masochistic attitude, but they would call it self-sacrificing attitude, where they play hurt all the time. They get shot up with painkillers. They do what they have to do to get back on the field. And Ted Johnson is sitting there saying, I need Bill Belichick, the coach, to understand that I'm a tough guy and I'm not going to fight this. He put it like this, they weren't going to beat me. That's how Johnson thought of it. And in fact, what Belichick had done had gotten Johnson to beat himself. And Johnson suffered a concussion shortly after this episode and has had struggled with cognitive problems, you know, really ever since. The truth of the matter is that's Bill Belichick being a good coach. The incentives are for him to get the quote-unquote most out of his players, and that means getting them to look past their own short and long-term health considerations because they can help the team.
The coaches are part of the system. The fans are a big part of the system. We haven't talked that much yet about the big business aspect of this system. We sort of briefly touched on the NFL itself, but we've got marketers, we've got PR people, we've got lobbyists. How would you describe this?
Well, it's basically a cartel. I mean, it's a legal monopoly. The NFL is tax exempt. Of course, the NCAA is a whole separate entity. They're a huge industry, and they've got a great business model because they've got free labor. And none of these college players get paid anything. They get a scholarship to the school, but there's not much real concern about their academic standing. The concern is that they're eligible on game day, at least at the big programs. And that's, I don't think anybody would deny that. That's just the reality. But at the pro level, so the NCAA, in other words, I want to say extort because, you know, in essence, we consent to it. The public consents to it. But 70% of the funding for stadiums, football stadiums around the country, pro football stadiums, is public money. Money that might be spent on schools or law enforcement or infrastructure or economic opportunity is spent building these huge stadiums. And the public does not see, for their tax dollars, does not see a return of 70% or 50% or 20%. They see a negligible return on that. The sports economists will say, who've really looked at the issue, essentially say, look, you know, NFL teams do create a lot of entertainment, but those entertainment dollars would be spent in other ways if there was no NFL team, and in ways that would probably be better for the local economy, since the NFL really only has about 8 or 10 games a year, and most of the jobs that are provided on game day are low-wage, temporary jobs. It's the circus approach to economic development. So that's what's happening in a macro way, and it means that we need to stop thinking about football as just something that the fans have an interest in. Everybody has an interest in it because it is a huge billion-dollar industry, and actually Roger Goodell wants it to be, if he sticks around, or his successor will want it to be even bigger And that's going to mean more invisible costs for products where the advertisers have to pay a lot to advertise. The networks and the cable packages that we buy are going to get more and more expensive. There are these sort of invisible costs that are passed on to all of us that we don't associate with football, but that are basically the profits are going into the pockets of very, very wealthy men. They really operate in a risk-free business environment. I mean, it's pretty galling when you think about the idea that this industry that generates $10 billion a year in revenues is tax-exempt.
We've also got a lot of racial issues caught up in this.
There's a bunch of excuses, kind of rationalizations that football fans carry around. And I know this because I was a football fan and still am, I guess, in the sense that I still love the game. I just don't consume it anymore. But, you know, you carry around a little suitcase full of rationalizations. The first one is, oh, the players are adults. They're, you know, they make this decision. They have free will. They earn a lot of money to play the game. And so it's that the moral decision, that's their responsibility. But in fact, their salaries, all the inducements for them to play, come from our devotion as fans. Without us, actually, there is no NFL. We're ultimately the people who created the football industrial complex. And so that's what my book is trying to get people to realize is, hey, we the fans are also the sponsors. Another line that people use all the time is that football is the only way out for a certain kind of kid. And in the coded language that we tend to use in the United States, what we really mean is a poor kid, a kid from an economically vulnerable neighborhood, and usually a kid of color. You know, 2/3 of the NFL are African Americans. And the truth of the matter is that that is an absurd and degrading idea of economic opportunity. That if you get, we're saying essentially to young kids of whatever color, but most of them happen to be African American, if you get, here's how you can succeed. We're not going to give you a good school or good teachers or, you know, support for your working parent or guardian. But what we're going to do is if you get really good at a super savage game, we are going to give you a 1 out of 500 possibility that you're going to make a whole bunch of money. And if 1 out of 500 high school seniors who play football wind up actually in the NFL, and they end up in the NFL for 3.5 to 4 years, and they're usually broke, you know, within several years of leaving the league. So it's really a lotto ticket mentality. It's a distraction from the fact that it's not okay for 1 out of 500 kids to succeed and find economic salvation. We should be worried about the other 499 who aren't great football players.
Tying back to your earlier point, which is so many of them end up with brain damage, brain injuries.
You know, their health is compromised. And more than that, there's no interest taken in the content of their character, in their intellectual development, in their moral development. They're really trained, they're segregated and trained from a very early age to be good at one very limited thing. And it's an amazing thing to be good at. You know, to be a professional athlete, I'm not trying to take anything away from how hard that is and, you know, how courageous the guys are, but it doesn't really prepare them for the totality of what life might bring them. It really is they lead a profoundly segregated life.
Steve Almond, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Steve Almond is a journalist and author of 3 books, including his latest, Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto.
When we come back, how comedy and humor impact everything from our health to our societies. Stay tuned.
I think healthcare should be free for all Americans. That's just my opinion. Yeah. For you guys who didn't clap, that means you can't relate. Let me tell you something. It's messed up when you're too broke to go to the doctors. You know you should be at the doctors, but instead you in CVS at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to diagnose yourself. You be walking in like, oh, shit. My kidneys are messed up. I better get me some NyQuil. Can't hurt NyQuil is good for bad kidneys. Let me get some Tums for this tumor I got, too. You know, Tums is in the word tumors.
That was award-winning comic actor Reuben Paul. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Humor affects many things: our health, our disposition, our relationships, and our organizations. Can it also help to change politics and society? With us are three experts. Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrill is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw also joins us. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you. John Morrill, I'd like to start with you for a historic context. You've traced the origin of humor historically. You've looked at it even in animals. What does history tell us about humor?
Well, the current best theory, I think, of the evolution of humor is that it evolved from a rough-and-tumble kind of play in apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees, from whom we split in evolution about 6 million years ago, have a kind of laughter that's kind of hard to pick up because it's on the intake rather than the outtake. So instead of laughing ha-ha-ha, they laugh ah-ah-ah. It's kind of like panting. And what it accompanies is mock wrestling, chasing and biting, the kind of things that you do with a little kid. And just as with a little child, when chimps and gorillas chase each other and wrestle each other to the ground and pretend that they're aggressive, they give a signal that they're only playing, and that signal is laughter. So for me, the best theory of the evolution of laughter and humor is that they came from a kind of rough-and-tumble play where it was necessary that they signal to the other person, look, I'm not out to hurt you. I'm not out to break your skin when I pretend to bite you, for example. And that laughter was this play signal. You can see this today when somebody tries to be funny, but they don't give any indication that you're trying to be funny. Well, what that usually ends up in is being threatening. The great example of that was Andy Kaufman, who for years after he left Saturday Night Live went around the country challenging women to wrestle him and defeat him, but he didn't put it in any kind of play frame. He didn't give any comedic hints that he was only playing. So he would show up these wrestling places, and he'd have women who really took him seriously and really wanted to hurt him. So when we are playing and when we want to engage in humor, we need laughter to signal that we're only playing.
Peter McGraw.
So what John says is, I think, is absolutely right, that the origins of humor started with play, but as humans developed and started to have other sorts of rules, new linguistic rules and cultural rules and societal rules, the things that became threatening or that could become wrong started to expand. And so the things that we find funny now have moved beyond the physical. Now it can be toilet humor, things like puns, moving outside of that, satire, irony, sarcasm, and so on. And the work that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab has identified an explanation for that, something that we call benign violations, that we tend to laugh at, we are delighted by, amused by situations that seem both wrong and okay, in the same way that rough and tumble play is playful and fun when it's both a violation, there's some threat, and then also some idea of, oh, this is okay, this is safe, this is playful. And so this evolution has moved up and branched out and has created what is really a complex yet exciting topic of research.
Amber Day, in your introduction, you look at various kinds of satire. And one of the things that you noted in your, I think it was in the literature review, was that it used to be really the art of the aristocrats, but now it's like a tool for the populist.
So that's how it sort of grossly gets characterized. I don't know that that's entirely true across the board. I think there was, for a long time, literary scholars considered it a conservative art form because it was used in that way. I think there's certainly examples that go against that grain. But there's definitely, you know, there's power in humor, and I think it can be used in either direction. So you can use it certainly to sort of put people in their place and remind them of the status quo and that they're stepping outside of it and using it for ridicule, and that tends to be from top down. But you can certainly also use it to question and to deconstruct the official line and, you know, to point out ironies, and that tends to be more of a sort of subversive bottom up.
Ironies, absurdities, but then, yes, you know, the idea of laughing at rather than laughing with.
Is certainly different than the sort of evolutionary start of it, in a way.
When we talk about laughing at versus laughing with, Peter McGraw, I think you were the one who wrote the piece on partisanship and humor. First of all, it sounded like the left won the humor quotient, hands down, but they have different preferences for humor. Conservatives like one kind of humor and liberals like another. Can you break that down for us?
Certainly. The intuition is that the Democrats are the funny party. But I think to Amber's point, a lot of that is the sort of laughing at, the attacking the traditions and attacking those people in power. But when it comes to being funny, more generally, liberals and conservatives seem to be more equal. It's not clear that there's good evidence that liberals are funnier people. And some work done by Dan Ariely reveals that. That in some ways, depending on the topic, conservatives really have a much better time. I think that follows what we tend to find, this idea that benign violations is subjective. It depends on your values and your beliefs and your experiences. So what's funny to one person is not funny to another. And as a result, in some sense, everybody's funny. Everybody has equal opportunity to be funny, whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative.
And then, of course, there's just the infectiousness of Joe Biden laughing the entire time during his vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan.
Indeed. Yeah, and that's certainly a case where he was using laughter as ridicule.
So in this case, you think he was laughing at Paul Ryan?
Well, I think that he was using laughter to point out the ridiculousness, the absurdities of the things that Ryan was saying, and in a way that was designed to kind of resonate with his party.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in here. Now, you've looked at this philosophically, and you say that we really value comic characters more than other types of heroes, like the tragic hero. First of all, tell us why that is, and then walk us through the Barack Obama kind of comic role.
Sure. One of the things that I've studied is the contrast between the heroic tradition, which lasted in American politics well into the 20th century. People like, well, take a turn of the century president like William Howard Taft or even the early Teddy Roosevelt. These people were frequently military veterans, or Eisenhower would be an even better example. These are people who were often military veterans, and they were part of a long tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, where the leader is somebody who tries to maximize power. They try to maximize their own knowledge. They try to be on top of everything. And they typically don't laugh very much at themselves. There's a newer style of leadership, which has grown up in the U.S. and throughout the world in the last 30 years or so, which I call post-heroic. And in this style of leadership, you don't emphasize the difference between you and the people you govern. In corporations, for example, in the last 30 years, they've leveled the pyramid. That is, that they've cut out a lot of the levels of organization. And so you see CEOs talking to ordinary people on the manufacturing line. The newer style of leadership tends to have a lot more humor in it. When I do talks like this for political groups and business groups, I often use William Howard Taft, who was not only a very kind of a stuffy president, but he was also our nation's fattest president. On the day of his inauguration, he weighed something over 300 pounds, and there was a new bathtub in the White House. And he got stuck in the tub, and it took four guys over 2 hours to extricate him from the tub. But he swore everybody to secrecy because he wouldn't want the population of the U.S. laughing at him. If you contrast that with somebody like Barack Obama, Obama isn't the funniest guy in the world, but he can certainly poke fun at himself. One of my favorite examples was between the time he was elected and his inauguration. He was in a press conference, and they were throwing him all kinds of tough questions about the economy, which was in a shambles, and all kinds of stuff. And finally, somebody threw him a softball question, and they said, "We hear that you're going to get a dog for the White House for your daughters. What kind of dog are you going to get?" And Obama said, "Well, at first we thought we wanted to get a mutt." And then he said, "Like me." And to me, that was just a watershed moment for a president to say a mutt and then like me, because he's half black, he's half white. It showed a guy who could poke fun at himself. And that kind of leadership is found not just in politics, but also in business. If you look at CEOs today, for example, versus, say, 50 years ago, they've removed the tie. A lot of them have also removed the sport jacket or the suit jacket. And the hero of this movement is Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's built a very successful corporation, largely on his playfulness, his sense of humor, and his ability to link both of those to spirit of camaraderie and equality. Humor tends to level differences between people. So when a president or a CEO or your boss can engage in really open humor, I'm not talking about sarcasm or put down, but really open humor, everybody can relax and social relations go a lot better.
Amber Day, this is a perfect place to bring you in because you've looked at this as a form of dissent also, and you've studied all kinds of political dissent, whether it was satire or some other kinds of activism. How do you see this now shaping the political landscape with the new satirists in town?
Sure. I found that last point really interesting, and I kind of want to jump off of it because I feel like it's not just in leadership, but it's become more of a cultural norm to sort of to use a kind of self-deprecating or self-referential irony. And that in many circles, that somehow kind of signals an honesty or a trustworthiness. I think that's partially because of the way in which political discourse, in particular the sort of public debate, is so kind of stage managed, so perfect, so you know, shiny and fake in many ways, right? We all know the way it's staged, and yet there's this frustration in the way in which the press isn't doing the best job of getting through that, you know, getting past the talking points that have been pre-scripted and all of that. And so I think where a lot of the sort of interesting political satire is coming out these days and the hunger for it is this desire to see somebody actually kind of poke holes in that spectacle and do so in a way in which they're not necessarily an expert, but they're also kind of drawing attention to who they are and that they don't claim to be perfect and that they don't necessarily have all the answers. So there's a sort of humble irony employed there.
And you've noted that this has actually transformed at least some of our comics, our comedians, into really legitimate pundits, or at least semi-legitimate pundits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a figure like, you know, Jon Stewart, of course, is the first one to come to mind, is quite different than what's come before. A few decades ago, Chevy Chase was everybody really liked his impression of the presidents and they liked his Weekend Update shtick, but you would never ask Chevy Chase seriously for his take on contemporary politics. Nobody would think of doing so, but Jon Stewart is doing something quite different than what Chevy Chase was doing.
Right, and Jon Stewart happens to be quite learned and well-read and brilliant at the same time, which perhaps is what makes a great comic.
I think so. Well, you can be funny in many different ways, but the way in which he's funny and the things that resonate are because he is really sort of revealing things, pulling back the curtain on some of that political debate and some of the staged nature of political discourse and really letting us watch how it's put together in a way that's incredibly satisfying, I think.
Peter McGraw, that sort of touches on something that was in one of your blogs, which deals with the humor being sort of counter-establishment by its nature. And how do you see that fitting in with today's politics?
You know, one of the roots of sort of stand-up comedy is entertainment, comes out of the motif of the trickster, of the court jester. And on my Humor Code travels, my co-author Joel Warner and I met with Patch Adams. And I can't repeat the language that Patch used, but he basically said that the court jester is the only person who can call the king a jack, you know. And so he actually used more flavorful language than that. And that tradition continues today, where comedians, stand-up or otherwise, are taking aim at the things that are wrong with the traditions, with the people in power, with government, with media. And the Jon Stewarts of the world, they happen to be doing it, you know, better than anyone else, in part because Jon Stewart is really adept. He's quick on his feet. He's a quick thinker. He also has a writer's room full of very funny Harvard graduates who are helping him out along the way. And the very best comedians that we've found on the road are ones that can take aim at themselves, as John and Amber mentioned, in part to increase that level of credibility, that if they can make fun of themselves, then they certainly can make fun of all these other things that are wrong in the world.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in then. You've talked about the benefits of humor. It helps us individually. You've talked about various ways it helps organizations. How do you think it's beneficial for politics of the world?
It's interesting that the beginning of comedy was in the 5th century BCE in Athens, Greece. And the beginning of democracy was in 5th century Athens, Greece, 5th century BCE. I think that there's a very strong link between people being able to joke about their leaders, to poke fun at their shortcomings, their hypocrisy, their screw-ups, etc., and their political freedom. So I think that there's a strong link between open societies and democratic values and this ability to have people like Jon Stewart around. If you look at countries that are repressive, if you look, for example, at several countries in the Middle East, where joking about the leader can get you executed, you see the opposite of this. And in the West, probably the strongest example of somebody who repressed humor was Hitler. When Hitler was rising to power in the late 20s and early 30s, the first people who criticized him were stand-up comedians. At that time, they were called cabaret comics. And when Hitler came to power in 1933, one of the first things that he did was establish special courts for prosecuting people who made fun of his Third Reich or made fun of the brown shirts or made fun of the way the Nazis were told to march, etc. And over 100 people were executed. One stand-up comic in Berlin, for example, was executed. He was hanged for naming his horse Adolf. If you look at the Soviet Union, there was a similar pattern. The Soviet Union wanted to control humor and suppress humor that was critical of the leader. And they even set up a special journal, which came out every 10 days in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It had a larger circulation than Time magazine and Newsweek magazine put together in this country, and it was called Crocodile. And what they allowed humor about was inefficiency, bureaucratic red tape, people being drunk on the job, people not doing their work. But what they didn't allow was jokes about the leadership. So the secretary of the Communist Party was never a legitimate target. So governments have known since the days of ancient Egypt, when the first court jesters were in place, that humor is powerful, and humor may be playful, but it can be playfully critical. And so governments that are more open allow for more humor. Governments that are more controlled and repressive are afraid of humor.
Amber Day, I don't recall if you actually had this in your literature or in your book, but can you tell us what kind of a measurable impact some of these new, what you called Renaissance comics, are making in society in America today or in the other countries that you looked at?
The short answer is no, but I think, yes, the problem is sort of how do you measure that effect, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? And I think we tend to sort of look at it very simplistically and say, well, is this one piece going to have a measurable effect on the next election? And the answer is usually no, of course it isn't. But I think these comics and, you know, a number of the filmmakers, the activists that I'm looking at are making a difference and they are doing something. But I think it's smaller. I think it's shifting the conversation in small ways, changing the terms in which we talk about particular issues, or even actually pushing issues that were very peripheral and only sort of talked about in marginal counterpublics, pushing those further into the wider public sphere and into the wider discussion. And I think that's huge. And that's the kind of thing, these shifts have to happen before change ever takes place, right? Because sort of public perception has to change, but it is the stuff that's incredibly hard to actually track and measure.
We do know from the, I think it's the Pew studies, that The Daily Show was certainly the leading source of news, political news for young people, particularly through the election periods.
Right.
Perhaps we should take a little shift and talk about, well, what makes things funny? And this is something that you've all looked at as well. Peter McGraw, that's kind of the whole subject of your institute. Why don't you start us with this? Why are some things funny and some things not?
So, yeah, so I recognize that some of my theorizing isn't always popular as a kind of outsider moving into this field. My expertise is in judgment and decision-making and the study of emotion more generally. And when I stumbled on this question, I surveyed the research, including John's work, and found hints at different perspectives, one that's different than the traditional view of humor arising from some form of incongruity, that there's some mismatch between what we expect and what we get in the world. And as I mentioned earlier, I, based on my reading, came to the conclusion that actually humor has a counterintuitive underpinning, that of something negative, what we call a violation. And luckily, there's support for this by people a lot smarter than me. Mark Twain has a great quote where he says that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. That is because because heaven's perfect, there's nothing actually to laugh at. And the studies that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab seem to help support that idea. But of course, the things that are violations don't normally amuse us. They upset us. And so you have to have this other judgment, this recognition that the situation is safe or acceptable or okay, or as we say, benign.
So then it really could collapse into the tragic.
So the tragic is actually a really good source of humor in many ways, but it also keeps with a saying that's at least been attributed to Mark Twain, that the humor is tragedy plus time, that as time passes, as you get some distance from the thing that's bad, it helps transform it from a violation into a benign violation.
And John Morrell, would you agree?
Yes. Peter's notion of a benign violation fits fairly well with the traditional theory called the incongruity theory, which says that in a humorous situation, something violates your expectations. You expect A and you get not A, or even better, you get the opposite of A. So your expectations are violated. That's part one. And part two is you don't go into a negative emotion. You don't get scared. You don't become sad or depressed. You're not disgusted or angry. Instead, you are able to enjoy the incongruity. You're able to enjoy this surprise. Humans are the only ones who can pull this off. You can surprise your cat, for example, by moving her food dish to a different spot in the kitchen. You can dress up in a funny Halloween costume in front of your dog, but you'll never get a laugh out of either one of them. So humans are the only ones who can experience something that they weren't ready for, even the opposite of what they were ready for, and even including their own disappointments and their own mistakes, and somehow enjoy it. They can have their mental train derailed and enjoy the train wreck. So Peter's notion of a violation, which is safe or okay or benign, I think it works very well. And you notice that in some situations, the same event which surprises, say, a room full of people, will make some of them angry and others of them amused. So I think there's a personal difference between people who go into a negative emotion versus people who go into laughter instead. And that's basically what Peter referred to quickly as distance. I call it mental distance. People who can laugh about things typically see it from a higher perspective. They step back. They're less emotionally engaged. People who tend to experience everything with anger or fear or sadness or depression tend to be emotionally wrapped up in things. And that's the heart of tragedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy isn't the subject matter. In comedy and in tragedy, the subject matter is disappointment and failure and suffering and death and our inability to understand what's happening to us. Comedy isn't about happy, successful people doing well. It's about the same thing tragedy is about. But the tragic character goes into her emotions. She gets swept away by them. The comic character steps back and thinks her way rather than feels her way through her problems.
Amber Day.
I would just add to that a little bit, but I don't think we should see comedy, humor, irony as completely removed from the serious or the feeling or, you know, feeling very strongly about something. Because there tends to be this assumption that, you know, somebody like Jon Stewart, well, it's bad for politics, right? It's cynical. And, you know, we're just laughing at it. We're not really caring about it. And I spend a lot of time sort of pushing against that assumption because I think what's really interesting about a lot of the political humor in particular that we see right now is a lot of it is actually very earnest, you know, and it's being used to rile us up to some degree, particularly in some of the activist groups that I take a look at, or some of the viral videos that we see circulating before an election. They tend to use irony and humor and satire to get our attention and to grab us. And I think there is that aspect of the benign violation because the satisfaction comes in knowing, wow, somebody else notices this, right? Somebody else is seeing this. And that makes me feel a little bit better. But I think the intended effect, a lot of the time, if it is being used to garner attention or to actively get people involved in something, is to get them mad, really, or to get them upset about it and feel like there are other people who are laughing at the same thing and who are upset about the same thing and that there's sort of that strength in numbers.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. John Morrell, Amber Day, Peter McGraw, it's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrell is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Huatema Galeman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.